This is Rock and Roll Grad School with your hosts, Heidi Hedquist and Luke Poling. First-time callers, long-time listeners.
Hello, kiddies. We're going to have a good time together. How are you doing, Heidi? You're tired?
I'm exhausted.
But are you ready for the gathering tonight?
I am not going to the gathering tonight. Are you ready?
I should be, but for someone who doesn't, but wait a second, for someone who doesn't shut up about Detroit, suddenly the Insane Clown Posse's gathering of the Juggalos are just like, I'm too good for this.
I didn't say I was too good for it. I have been busy working on
That's
our
true.
Behalf in New York. I have been a Brooklynite for 3 days.
This is true. So the EP Pug Ugly is coming out on Friday.
Okay.
And they say it will be exclusively available at the gathering starting today. So if you just want to swing by on your way home from work.
Isn't the gathering not here, though? I think that's part of my issue.
Oh, maybe.
I believe they took it out of state, and I'm not down with that.
Okay, well, fine.
Is it in Ohio?
I'm looking. That might be right, given that... Gathering the Juggalos. You're right. Legend Valley, Ohio, the 3rd through the 6th. Well,
I've been to their show.
But you haven't been to the gathering.
I've not been to the gathering. I've had pancakes at Denny's a table away from them.
All right.
So. Two good ICP stories, so.
That's true. But, so if you happen to be in Ohio and are at the gathering, you can pick out the new EP. However, there is something that we need to download immediately. And then spend the rest of our week messing around with.
Okay.
Violent J and Shaggy Do Too Dope also have created their own Instagram filter.
Oh, yes.
Which will allow users to wear either Violent J or Shaggy Too Dope's iconic clown makeup.
Who do you want to be?
I want to take everybody from the Mudhouse family of podcast networks and put them in ICP makeup.
We could totally.
And I would say no one's going to notice it, but no one's going to notice it.
Our friends and fans will notice it.
This is true, yes. And hopefully Violent J and Shaggy Too Dope.
Right.
So, and we'll have to email our friend Amy and let her know we're discussing this so that she knows we are down with the sickness or whatever. Uh-huh. What did they say? We're not Juggalos, I don't think.
Not quite.
Yeah.
We could be at some point.
We could. Speaking of which, their documentary film, United States of Insanity, very, very fun, or very good film about their fight with the FBI, about the accusations of being labeled as gang members. But we're not here to talk about people with faces painted.
No.
We're not here to talk about KISS. We're here to talk about Arista Records. Let me grab the book here.
Yes, I don't have my book.
Looking for the Magic, Mitchell Cohen. Fun little book about the early history of Arista Records. Who are they responsible for? Well, I'm glad you asked, Heidi.
Whitney
Houston, Patti Smith, Gil Scott-Heron. They ended up signing the Kinks, sort of the revival of the Kinks. The Grateful Dead. Mm-hmm. Lou Reed, Barry Manilow, all of your favorites. Our friend Nikki. So many, and it was fun talking with Mitchell about all of this because he was there for so much of it and got to kind of be in the room when they played some of these tracks for the first time. He was actually at the famed Lou Reed Take No Prisoners show at the Bottom Line, which as soon as I found that out, interview went off the rails, let's just put it lightly. But we talk all about that. That book is available right now. And I love the shape of it. There's something kind of cool about it that makes it stick out.
I love the shape of it too.
That it is it is
the photos round. Are amazing.
It's like a 45 size, right?
Yes.
Maybe. Yeah. A little bit big. It's bigger.
Yeah.
Somewhere between a 7, not a 33, not a 45.
It's just cool. It's a cool book. It can go on your coffee table.
Mm-hmm.
It can go on a nightstand easily.
Mm-hmm.
It's an easy read.
Yeah, it's lovely. thinking about writing this book?
Yeah, you know, the book had been on my mind for a while. You know, people had asked me, you know, occasionally, because I collaborated with Matt Finfield on his memoir, and his agent, you know, suggested that I might want to write something like that from my perspective as a music industry insider guy. But, you know, I never felt like I wanted to write my experiences in the music business. I didn't want to, because my experiences are unique to me, but there have been so many books. I mean, I'll be like, you know, how I got into business, and, you know, the rock stars I met, people I signed, or whatever.
Right.
But then BMG Books began doing a series called the RPM series of individual books on important, influential, independent record labels. They did one on Sub Pop. They did one on Specialty. They assigned one on Chrysalis. I know they were going to do Slash. So I found out who edited that RPM series and pitched the idea of doing a book on our first decade, essentially when it was a New York-based independently distributed record label. And because I thought that would give me a way to tell a lot of different stories. So I could tell the story, obviously, of Arista's inception, but also its pre-story of how it evolved out of, you know, Bell, Amy, Mala Records. And also sort of take a snapshot of New York in the 70s. You know, the music scene, the cultural scene in general. So I got the assignment to do the Arista, you know, the Arista book in the RPM series. And I worked on it for a year, interviewed about 25, 30 people, and delivered the book in February of 2020.
Famous last words.
Right before the pandemic hit.
Yeah. I
mean, just bang, it was on their desk, bang, everything shut down. So then it was on hold for about a year. Then when everybody started getting back into the swing of things, there was a change at the top of BMG Books. The whole RPM series was canceled and I was stuck with a book, you know, and and no way to get it out there until I started talking with Ira Robbins at Trouser Press, who had been putting out books under the Trouser Press label. He and I began to talk, and that's how and where it ended up there.
And I mean, you said, like, it's interesting. Your book, I love it because there's not a lot of name drops in it. Or if they are, it's very germane to the story. It's not, like you said, some of the other books that have been out there that are very name droppy, and this party and this thing. And
it just Yeah. I wanted to sort of keep myself out of it as a character. I mean, it's like I was there and I was an eyewitness to all the stuff during that decade of Arista. But I wanted it to be like a more universal story than just my experiences of walking in the door and meeting Clive Davis, or the first time I met Whitney, or Ray Davies, or Lou Reed, or, you know, sort of like, because, you know, everybody in the business to some extent or another has those kind of encounters, and, you know, has the kind of job that brings them in proximity and stuff. And when people did ask me to write something more personal, more autobiographical, let's say, they always wanted to know the dirt. You know, they wanted to, you know, what really happened in Clive's office during this, and that, or when I was at Columbia, then I was at Columbia after that. And it's like, oh, do you have any stories about Tommy Mottola and Mariah Carey or something like that? And I'm like, I'm not interested in telling those stories. I mean, even if I knew about them, it's not why I'm in the music business. And, you know, I feel like, if you have a relationship with your, you know, colleagues and the artists you work with, some things, you know, should stay in the, behind office doors. I mean, it's just, you know, I signed an artist named Maxwell at when I was at Columbia, you know, a pretty important R&B artist. And, you know, people, you know, always wanted me to, like, well, what was it like? What was the demo process like? What was it like when you first delivered, you know, this record to the R&B department. And I'm like, you know what? That's kind of attorney-client privilege. That's sort of like A&R mm-hmm. guy, artist, you know, all the things that go on, all the behind the scenes, you know, obstacles and negotiations are not that interesting to me. I mean, I'm interesting in, you know, in the music and the marketing of the music, the promotion of the music, what the artist is trying to say, what the label stands for in this case. Not in like saying, oh yeah, the, you know, this happened, that I should say at this party, you know,
right.
Yeah, or you know, this is you know, the encounter that this publicist had with this, you know, artist, you know, during, say, the Milli Vanilli or something.
Right. Yeah. And so during the early kind of formative days of Arista, you've got, like you say in the book, you've got Clive Davis kind of trying to not reinvent, but sort of rebuild himself and his brand and sort of show that he still has the skill given sort of the, I guess, do we say controversy that pushed him out at CBS?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we could definitely say controversy. Yeah, I mean, you know, for you know, people who might not know or listening, yeah, Clive Davis ran Columbia Records and Epic Records, but brought them headlong into the rock era. Signed artists like Big Brother and the Holding Company and Blood Sweat Tears and Santana, and you know. I mean, Columbia had always been a powerhouse, but it was only tentatively becoming like a rock force. And then after a period of great success from like 67 to 73, he lost his job at CBS Records under a cloud of scandal that really amounted to nothing, you know, at the end of the day. So, He spent a year, you know, working on his on book, and then, you know, there was all this speculation on the music industry, like where would Clive Davis end up? What would be his next move? It wasn't like he was gonna be. He was still a relatively young man, and had built this, you know, let's call it an empire, and yeah. You know, was he gonna do, a joint label deal with Warner Brothers, or was he going to, you know, end up running, let's say, Capitol or something, or start something of his own? So I was a rock writer at the time. I wasn't a business professional by any means. But so when I found out that, you know, that Columbia Pictures had hired him to take over Bell Records, even I, as like just a sort of like a on the sideline spectator, said like, "Well, Bell Records. I know what Bell Records is. I mean, I had a bunch of their records in my collection for sure, but you know, it had a reputation of being like a very, very pop label, very single driven label, and obviously that was not the way he wanted to keep it. He wanted to make it in his image,
right?
Which is to say, like a mini version of what he was doing over at CBS, a broad album-oriented label that did, you know, rock and jazz and you know, pop as well, of course. But so in a way, it was like his comeback story. Even though, you know, he hadn't been gone very long, for sure,
right?
To be sure, but it was sort of like validation of his abilities to talent and find hit songs and to take a leap of faith on some artists that were not not on the surface necessarily mainstream type people. And, you know, Patti Smith, Bill Scott Heron, Anthony Braxton, signed Lou Reed, after Lou Reed's thing at RCA, he signed the Kinks, who were also like in a sort of a slump at the time.
Yeah, the rebuilding.
At RCA, he signed the Grateful Dead, who, you know, after a very good run at Warner Brothers, was sort of floundering around trying to do things independently. So, you know, my job in telling this story was to, you know, talk to as many people as I could who were there during the transition And, you know, so it put me in contact with a lot of people that, you know, that had been, you know, my predecessors there or my colleagues there or, you know, producers that worked for him or, you know, and, you know, it was a fascinating process for someone who's interested in music history, music label history, history specifically.
Yeah. Now, as a complete aside, is Bell Records connected to Al Bell? Because I know that Stax was sold. It's completely different. Okay.
Bell began as a children's label.
Okay.
And then was a label that did like knockoffs of top 40 hits that you would find like the Woolworths and stuff, like for like 39 cents. And then became quite a powerhouse. I mean, you know, Bell, Amy, and Mala had a lot of hits, in mostly in pop and R&B. Mm-hmm. The Box Tops and Del Shannon and Mitch Ryder and Detroit Wheels and James and Bobby Purify and Lee Dorsey. And yeah, I mean, I certainly have a lot of those records in my collection, and everyone I know does. But
right.
But what was fascinating to me, you know, in doing the research and digging through old issues of Billboard and Record World, was to find out that Larry Utah, who ran Bell Records, had a unique A&R philosophy, which is to say, not to have an A&R department, you know, per se. But he didn't make records; he made deals with people who made records. You know, he made a deal with Marshall Seahorn and Alan Toussaint, who had a label down in New Orleans, or with Bob Crew, who brought him Mitch Ryder and Norman Tanega and the Toys. And he, you know, he made deals with the Memphis guys that brought him the Box Tops, or, you know, James and Bobby Purify. He would identify local sources of music, and then just trust the source to bring him product, and made a lot of trips to England, you know, to pick up masters, you know, to license to the U.S. records that had already been made and distributed there. It was, I had never seen anything like it, you know, in reading those articles. Every label that you or I are familiar with on that scale, every independent label from Town to A&M, to Specialty, to Jazz, to, you know, to Atlantic, Barry Webster, the person at the top was essentially the A&R head. I mean,
right.
That you walked in the door and, Sam Phillips or Ahmed Erdogan or Valbert and Jerry Moss or whatever, there was someone there who would make an assessment of the music and the artist and decide to sign the artist to the label. That's how it was always done. Larry Utah didn't do a lot of that. You know, people didn't walk into his office and audition for him. If he went to see a showcase of an artist, it was very rare, you know, because, I mean, but he would, you know, he would go to England and make deals with record makers like Mickey Most and Larry Page and Tony Visconti or, you know, Dick James and picked up some fascinating records along the way. I mean, the first Elton John single ever released in America was released on a subsidiary of Bell that would deal that Larry Utah made with Dick James Music, DJM Records. You know, and he had an option to put out the first Elton John album, but that single didn't sell and he didn't see the upside of it. So, you know, Elton John had to wait a little while and get signed to Uni, obviously, and the world knows what happened then. But it was fascinating, and certainly not the way Clive Davis worked. I mean, Clive Davis is the ultimate, you know, label head as A&R guy.
Mm-hmm.
Every decision on every song that every artist records, if they're not songwriters. I mean, obviously he didn't tell Ray Davies or Patti Smith what to record, but when it came to the pop artist, certainly every song had to go through the, you know, across his desk. He had to approve it. Every mix, every piece of artwork. I mean, he was the ultimate hands-on record executive. Larry Utah saw Bell as a promotion and marketing company of music, you know, and you know, that served him very well when he was putting out hits and when, you know, the market was mostly top 40 driven. It didn't serve him so well in what I guess you would have to call like the post Woodstock era, you know, when, right. you know, rock bands without pop hits couldn't like build up an underground following and sell a lot of records and get played on like what was then like album oriented radio, you know, it's like, you know, that was, you know, albums whose sales and success were not contingent on breaking a single top 40.
Right. And
so it was like, it was such a drastic shift in A&R, in A&R philosophy.
How did Arista handle that, or Clive Davis, in that kind of changeover? And because, like you said, the artists that you were working with at the time, there are definitely some kind of bands that had singles and artists that had singles, and then you had people who were much more, I mean, someone like Patti Smith, yes, she's had hit singles, as it were, on those very niche things, but Horses is not a singles album.
Right, but certainly not until the third album.
And right, so, yeah.
But Horses was a, you know, a landmark album, and it was handled as such from, mm-hmm. you know, from the company standpoint. The fact that, you know, the songs on Horses were not likely to get a lot of airplay was not, you know, from what I know from the people, I mean, I was a rock writer then, and, you know, I loved Horses. It was, you know, definitely my favorite album. And, you know, they would just, there was a commitment behind her, and I saw her recently. She was at Clive Davis's 90th birthday party. And she gave a little speech where she said that, you know, Clive just always let me be myself. You know, he allowed that. And, you know, it's one thing that people sometimes overlook, because he has such a reputation of being so involved, you know, that, but
right.
when it came to all the artists on the jazz roster, when it came to artists like Patti or Gil Scott-Heron or Lou Reed or Ray Davies, there was none of that. He didn't try and give them outside songs. He very rarely would suggest, you know, a producer. I mean, sometimes he would, but, you know, but it wasn't like, you have to work with this person. You're not going to tell Gil Scott-Heron or Patti Smith or Ray Davies, you know.
Right.
Like, you know, he's not going to say, you know, to the Kings, oh, you have to work with Jimmy Iommi. Or Ray Davies is going to make the decision. I mean, it's his band. But, and all that was like really fascinating stuff. Just as as someone, you know, to whom, you know, the history of pop music is like my thing. It's sort of like, you know, it's, you know, to be able to, you know, tell a very specific story that also is about New York City in the 70s and everything that was going on musically. You know, jazz, new wave, disco, and funk, and it was definitely fun to do that. And I was glad I found a premise on which to explore that stuff.
And New York is such a character in the book, like you mentioned, because of so many of the artists that are based out of there and that were doing things there. I mean, obviously Lou Reed and Patti Smith are kind of synonymous with Manhattan, but even, you know, Whitney Houston was in the area.
Whitney's from Jersey. Patti is from Jersey. Barry Manilow and Melissa Manchester on the other side of the coin. Clive himself is from New York City. He's from Brooklyn. You know, it's sort of like, you know, you just, you know, and I point this out in the book, and I said, you wouldn't necessarily think they have a lot in common, but Barry Manilow and Lou Reed do have a bunch of stuff in common. They're both from Brooklyn. They're only about a year apart in age.
As songwriters for Hire to start.
Jewish guys who in an earlier era may have been like Brill Building or 1650 songwriters. And, artists who came up in some version of the underground, whether it's like the Velvet Underground specifically, or the Continental Baths, you know, where Manilow, you know, came up as there's accompanist. I mean, there are more like parallels there than in those two artists than anybody, you know, that, you know, anybody, well, Barry Manilow and Lou Reed could not be more opposite. And yet they ended up on the same record label. You know what? You know, like I said, it's like at one point, you know, Barry Manilow might have been Neil Sedaka, you know, and maybe, you know, Lou Reed would have been Doc Thomas or something. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, you could see that, you know, it's like, oh, if they had been 10 years earlier, you know, what the paths might have been, and they might have crossed paths, you know, in the Brill Building.
In the process, I think you said this was your first label job.
Yeah,
it was. Is that my right? First, yeah. And then going on to other things afterwards and other labels, did you kind of realize, I guess in the moment, did you realize what a special, unique blend of artists you were?
Oh, that's why
being around.
I mean, I thought I was going to work for the coolest record company in the world. I mean, obviously there were a lot of very, very cool record companies in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
But I, you know, like I said, I loved Horses, and you know, and the Kinks were one of my favorite bands, and they had signed Martha Reeves and General Johnson and Gil Scott-Heron, and a big fan of Monty Python, and they.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
They had a Monty Python album. They signed the Grateful Dead, and in college, I had gone through the Grateful Dead period. There was all that cool stuff coming out on the jazz side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was like, oh yeah, great. I mean, this is exactly the kind of label I want to work for. I mean, I started out as a copywriter, writing, you know, bios and press releases, and then like ads and stuff. And then after the period covered by this book, I asked for not a so I ended up here there, and we've done to Columbia, and then over.
So, and that's the other thing that I didn't know much about the jazz side of Arista. And when you're going through one, you know, you've listed a bunch of them already, the artists who are on that label, and the way that so many of these records were sort of, I mean, there's the kind of compilation ones that were just like,
yeah, the one
you got someone to record for 3 days.
The
and
on Savoy. I mean, you know,
it's fascinating.
Acquired the Savoy catalog. And every few months, we would get a stack of those records: Lester Young and Charlie Parker, and, you know, Van Gess and Dizzy Gillespie. It's like, it was just like it was a gold mine of stuff, and it was a prestige-y thing to have, you know. And a lot of my friends specifically, were rock writers or music writers, and they would love to come up to the office and like, oh, you know, what's new? And, you know, what's the new Savoy stuff? You know, the Roots of Rock and Roll album, or the Black California album, or, you know, Bebop Piano album. Just, yeah, I mean, those things were like beautifully packaged and compiled and annotated. And Clive, again, to his credit, you know, one thing he wanted to make sure of was that these were handled with the prestige that they deserve, and that people would get paid, you know, that, you know, royalties, you know, would get paid, that track those people down and make sure they make money off of this. Because, you know, notoriously, you know, the head of Savoy, like Herman Lubinsky, was, he was like a notorious skinflint, and people hated working for him, and that's why there had to be so many compilation albums, because there were so many artists that didn't stick around long enough to make complete albums. They would make like two sides for him or four sides for him, and then like I've had it. So there were all these masters sitting there that had no albums attached to them, and so albums had to be created like thematically. It was a great series of stuff. And the stuff that Michael Cascuna was doing over at Novus with Steve Backer was just like groundbreaking stuff. Oliver Lake and Cecil Taylor and Gatto Barbieri and, you know, Rand Blake. The Twin Peaks of Arista, you know, Barry Manilow, Whitney Houston, you know.
Right.
Kenny G, like in the middle there and stuff. But, you know, and like one of the things I wanted to do when I was writing this was, you know, sort of do like historical, I could calling it this, a historical remix. You know, it's like, I'm not ignoring, you know, all the, you know, pop success I have, but I wanted to bring other things up in the mix. I wanted people to hear, you know, be aware of all this other stuff that was going on. It's like, oh, I didn't hear that piano part in that version, but right. Now I hear it. That's what it was to me. That's sort of like I'm taking the elements of the Arif story. Clive wrote his own book, which very, very thoroughly and, you know, in great detail discusses his perspective of Arif's history. I wanted to shed some light on some other parts of the story that have not been told that much. You know, sort of flashlight in a different corner. You know, it's like Willie Nile or David Foreman, or, you know, I mean, albums that deserve more attention than they got.
When you had all the Stiff label stuff coming over.
Yeah, there was that too. Yeah, I remember I'd been so excited because it was I had just begun at Aaron's. I was still a rock writer at the time, and I got an import copy of Elvis Costello's My Aim Was True, and I reviewed it for Cream magazine. And so I was so excited when I heard that we were trying to bring the Stiff record label to the Arif of the United States, and like, it's not the better thing. But then the two principal holders of Stiff like had a professional divorce. One ended up with Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe and brought those guys over to Columbia. We got the Stiff deal, but we got the Stiff deal without Elvis and Nick, which was a shame because obviously, I would have liked to have written the original stuff on Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe. That would certainly. That would have been a kick. But it was.
And Lou Reed had such a unique and interesting career with so many ups and downs, but Arista had was Sally Can't Dance on Arista? I'm trying to remember now.
No, that was
the RCA. But
we did Rock and Roll Heart. Street Hassle, Take No Prisoners, The Bells.
And that's the one I wanted to ask about, the Take No Prisoners.
Oh my God, I was there at the bottom line.
You were, wow.
Yeah, we all were. It was it was some weird combination of music and stand-up and he would use the songs, like some songs he would do like as songs and do like really compelling versions of, and some he would just use as riffs over which to sort of, you know, verbally like spritz, like, you know.
I was going to say complain, but spritz is a better way
Lenny
to
Bruce,
describe.
Yeah. He's got that Lenny Bruce thing in his voice and sort of like rail against whatever was on his mind at the time. And the fact that he delivered that as a live album was just hilarious to me. Yeah, that you know, it's like, here it is, here's my because at the time, you have to place this in context, the late 70s, you know, the double live album, you know, every artist had to have one. I mean, after Frampton Comes Alive, I mean,
right, yeah,
you know, like every artist, yeah, the double live album, that's every rock artist needed one. And of course, when an artist had been on other labels before, you want at least some versions in your catalog of their biggest songs. So theoretically, Arista would have gotten versions of like, you know, Sweet Jane and Rock and Roll, or I'm Waiting for My Man, or whatever. It's like that we could market. And instead he delivered this two album, that part tirade, part comedy record, part, you know, but also some beautifully played versions of some great songs. So it's quite a document. I don't think there's anything else quite like it.
And to go back to, I mean, just my mind is blown by the album, because like, knowing Lou Reed, knowing the Velvet Underground, this is such this weird anomaly where his sense of humor really comes through. I mean, loud and clear.
He was funny. I mean, he just was.
But like, was that? Was everyone expecting this? Did everyone know, like, this tour?
No,
or was that just one gig?
It was like a run of shows at the Bottom Line, and everyone knew what he was up to on stage. But the assumption was that all that would be edited out and he would deliver, right. You know, from each night, there would be a certain number of songs that would be like songs, that he would compile, he and his producer, engineer, or whoever he was working with at the time. But, you know, Clive did, you know, give complete creative control to people like Lou Reed and Patti Smith. That, you know, you put out what they brought in the door, and what Lou Reed brought in the door was Take No Prisoners. And, you know, it is in its way, like, hilarious. And as you said, like, you know, just a one of a kind thing.
And it's weird. I feel like it's not appreciated as much as, say, like Metal Machine Music, which everyone always goes to as like
everyone goes the to ultimate kiss the, off as of. The anomaly.
Yeah.
As the you know, FU to like expectations. You know, right. Sort of like, you know, you think I'm gonna follow up this with that, and I'm gonna take this turn. Take No Prisoners is probably like I can only imagine the discussions. Between you know Clive or whoever. Lou's product manager was, it's like, okay, we're going to book the bottom line for a week. Are you going to do shows? We'd love to get a double live album out by whatever month, you know.
It sounds like a Christmas record, you know.
Yeah, maybe put under the tree.
Yeah.
But, it's just one of those records that it's just like, you play it for people or, you know, you discuss it and people go, really? That's what's on it? And I'm like, yeah, he talks about rock critics for about...
Yeah, Rails and Robert Christgau for a while.
Like John Rockwell, you know, the Times, and, you know, Christgau gave me a B+, and it's like, okay, I mean, it's your record. Say what you want.
As we're kind of wrapping up... You know, again, like you said, the book covers both your time at Arista and sort of the overall early era of the record. Is there one album that came out while you were working there that you sort of feel like was your high point and like, I can't believe I got to be involved in some small way in the creation of this record?
Yeah,
record.
I wasn't involved with the making of Easter in any way. I wasn't an A&R guy yet. But I was a huge fan of Patti's, and she had just recovered from her accident. She had fallen off the stage on tour when she was promoting Radio Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
And she was making this record and she was coming back, and I went to meet her, you know, and interview her. She still had the brace on her neck. I went to meet her at 15th Avenue to start to do all the pre-press things. And that was like a thrill for me. And, you know, I brought her book with like a written book of poetry she signed it. And the night that she premiered Because the Night, I was in the audience. It was over the Christmas holiday, you know, so this would be late 1977. And everyone knew that she was working on something, but no one had heard anything from it. And a few of us from Arista who were fans and didn't go away for Christmas were there at the show. And she debuted this song, and Springsteen came out and sang it with her. And we all looked at each other like, this is the record that she's been waiting for, the record that Arista's been waiting for. We couldn't wait to get back to the office and tell people what Patti had. You know, that you're going to be so thrilled. I mean, she had always wanted to be on Top 40 radio. I mean, that was always like the, you know, the secret, you know, not so secret, but it's like she wanted to be played on WABC. That's how she grew up. She grew up in the New York City area. She wanted to be on WABC radio. And when we heard Because the Night, like, oh my God, this is the one. This is, you know, this is the third album thing that you wait for. This is, for lack of a better comparison, like her Born to Run, like on Spring, mm-hmm. third album or whatever, Refugee on Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, third album, like the song that just is the next level thing. And it was so perfect because, I mean, it wasn't a song that anyone gave her. It was a song that, well, Springsteen gave it to her, but then she, you know, reworked it, made it her own. And I talked to Lenny Kaye about it, and you know, Lenny walked me through a little bit of the how it went from the embryonic cassette to what happened in the studio. And he's like, yeah, we made it our own. We're like proud to do it. We'll do it every night. We stand behind that song. And, you know, just to be, you know, you don't get those moments very often. You hear something for the first time and just know that, oh yeah, this is going to be it. This is going to take over the world. Some tracks by Whitney were like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, like How Will I Know was like that. Just being in the room when Clive played it for the first time, you go like, oh, I get it. Or then when I was at Columbia, you know, the first time I heard Crazy in Love by Beyonce, you know, in an A&R meeting, you go like, oh, Jesus. You know, everyone in the world is going to be hearing this song in a few weeks. Those moments, those are the ones. I mean, those are the ones that stick with you when you go like, oh, we're here, you know, in this little room, experiencing this together, and soon it's going to just blow up.
Looking for the Magic, New York City, the 70s, and the Rise of Arista Records by Mitchell Cohen is available right now from Trouser Press Books, wherever you get your books. For more information, check out the Trouser Press website, trouserpressbooks.com. You can also follow them on Twitter, where they're at Trouser Press, and on Facebook, where they're at facebook.com/trouserpressbooks.
You can check us out on all the various socials. Be sure to visit our website at rockandrollgradschool.com, and don't forget to leave us a review.
Today's show is produced by myself and Heidi Hegquist. Our reluctant producers are John Sauvay and Sandy Stone. Our willing producers are Rachel Allen and Randy Jeanette. Our intern is Zach Jackson. This one's for Philippe. Thank you, good night, and may all your favorite bands stay together.